And you're on the front porch. This week, we're going to talk tax reform with Garrett Ballingy. He is the executive director of the Cardinal Institute here in West Virginia. But first, we'll talk about money music. I'm Scott Finn, executive director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, with Rick Wilson, the American Friends Service Committee. And what are we listening to right now?
We have a kumbaya moment. You know, Garrett and I don't see eye to eye on everything, but we agreed on a musical theme for this podcast episode.
What are we hearing?
It's Money, Money, Money by the OJs, a classic Motown song that I think fits the theme of the week and the upcoming weeks pretty well.
Well, it has some sort of tie to Donald Trump.
It was on The Celebrity Apprentice, you know, and I hate to, like, admit, but I watched something like, you guys listening, you should, like, find somewhere the Gary Busey Meatloaf season of Celebrity Apprentice. It was, like, transcendental.
Donald Trump had the better music, or maybe that just reveals who I am during the campaign. You can't always get what you want by the Stones. I mean, you know, I can't even remember what Hillary Clinton had.
And if I recall correctly, the artists weren't super thrilled about the use of him using their music.
Yeah, I don't think Neil Young was really into the whole keep on rocking in the free world thing.
Right.
They're appropriating your music, Rick.
That's right. Cultural appropriation.
You know, and speaking of appropriation and appropriations and taxes, we're going to discuss all these huge changes being discussed in Congress around taxes and what it might mean for West Virginia and West Virginians in general. And it's a moving target. So why don't we start with, what does the Cardinal Institute want to see happen?
Well, I think there are a few principles of sound tax policy that we would like to see. One, you want to broaden the base as much as possible. That gives you kind of what's called revenue stability. So if you are in an economic downturn or something like that, you're not seeing sort of these shortfalls, much like West Virginia did whenever energy prices really plummeted. You want it to be transparent. It's a good idea for people to know how much they're paying, where they're paying these types of things. You don't want tax in the cost of government, essentially, to be hidden from people. You want them to get a good idea of how much they're paying and where that money is going. You want it to be simple to the greatest extent possible. You don't want a ton of deductions or loopholes or credits or sort of favoring one group of people over another through the tax code. Complexity adds cost. It's a very expensive thing. It costs the economy a lot of money to comply with our tax code. And so to whatever extent you can simplify that and make it easy to comply with taxation, that's a good thing for the economy. So simplicity, transparency, broad bases, those are a few of the sort of pillars of what we would consider to be good tax policy.
So, Rick, I know that you have some issues with some of the things that are on the table right now at Congress.
Well, some of the concerns about what the House is talking about anyway, their estimates that it would increase the deficit by like $1.5 trillion. This is money that could double Pell Grants, could help with child care, that could help with job training and things like that. The bulk of it going to people who are very wealthy, who will see their benefit from it go up over time. It'll probably be used as an excuse to cut other programs down the road to pay for the tax cuts. Those are the kind of things that I'm concerned about.
Well, Garrett, let's talk a little bit about some of the things on the table, at least. So one of the things is something we've done in West Virginia, actually, over the last few years, which is a reduction in the corporate tax rate.
The United States has an extremely high corporate tax rate. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of that. If you look at us compared to the other OECD nations, which are about 35 of the most industrialized countries in the world, we have the highest corporate tax rate. We have the fourth highest effective corporate tax rate. And so if you're looking at this from purely a competitive standpoint, regardless of what your ideology is, regardless of what your views on who should pay what, you want to give the United States the most opportunities for investment. You want to attract foreign investment. We had major news that China may be investing on the order of tens of billions of dollars here. You want to make that type of thing occur more frequently. We're at 35% now. The proposal takes us down to about 20%. If I'm not mistaken, I believe the OECD average for corporate tax rate is about 22%. So that puts us kind of squarely in the middle. And with some of the other things that we've got going on as a country, I think we're very competitive.
Now, one thing I've heard is that there's this tax rate, which is 35%, and the effective tax rate, which is, I assume, what most companies actually pay after deductions and things. And it's a little bit lower because we have deductions and things.
And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the simplicity issue and things like that. If you eliminate deductions and all those different types of things, you can minimize or lower the corporate tax rate, which what does that do? That makes it less attractive to take on these sort of avoidance activities. It makes it less attractive, less of an investment to hire all these lobbyists and accountants and corporate tax attorneys and things like that. You want to minimize the incentive to do that kind of behavior because that's basically a deadweight loss to the economy.
I would be on board with this idea, and I think most people would be, the idea of, you know, getting rid of the games that people play to get their tax rate down, just eliminate those sorts of loopholes and deductions and things in exchange for a flatter, easier to understand rate. One of the concerns was that the House Republican plan, I thought, might keep some of those deductions and loopholes and lower the rate. And I think that was one thing that was...
Yeah, and that's, I think it's a good plan. I don't think it's a great plan. I think there are some decided negatives to it. If your goal is purely to incentivize growth, everything else being equal, I think it's a decent plan. Sort of what Rick was talking about as far as deficits, completely agree with that. It makes me a little bit nervous. The average person when they're born in 2017, a person born today has about $45,000 in public debt. That increases by the time they're 18 to $111,000. This is not a good thing for the economy in the long term. And so I think sometimes where conservatives get into trouble, especially overly optimistic ones, is they make the claim that these are going to pay for themselves.
I'd like to pick up on that theme, if that's all right. Well, you know, the Laffer curve thing?
Sure, absolutely.
So one thing I think I can say as a martial arts geek of the Japanese style is that Laffer does not subscribe to the samurai code of honor. When he said in the 70s and 80s that by cutting taxes, you would actually increase revenues and sort of staking him on that. If you staked yourself on it and it's never happened, then a samurai would probably be honor bound to, you know, commit seppuku.
So Republicans were really worried about deficits when Obama's in office and Democrats weren't. And now Democrats are talking about deficits. What Garrett's talking about, this idea of lowering the rate, getting rid of some loopholes, besides the fact you don't like the fact that it might end up with less money in government in general, but do you think that that ends up benefiting mostly wealthy people at the expense of lower income people? Is that what you're saying?
I think what's on the table in the House, generally most of the benefits will go toward the upper 1%. And then when you talk about corporate tax rates, there's a huge difference between the rate and the effective rate. And there are a lot of very profitable corporations that don't pay any U.S. income tax. So it is true there are a bunch of ambiguities there that could be cleared up, and there's a lot of lack of transparency there. But
I mean, that drives me nuts, right? I mean, it's like I don't get away with not paying any taxes, and there are companies that have figured out ways to get around it, and there are other companies that pay the full freight. That's the thing that drives people nuts, I think.
An overly complex tax code with a million deductions and loopholes and incentives and things like that, who does that benefit? It benefits established players. It benefits Fortune 500 companies. It puts at a disadvantage small business owners, you and me, for example, who can't go out and hire a $500 an hour attorney. So I think if we minimize the complexity of this and we make it easier for everyone to file their taxes, we're going to see some of that advantage that's given unnaturally to large established players begin to erode away. And I think over time, that's going to benefit all of us, not simply the biggest guys in the room.
Let's talk a little bit about income taxes. That is a piece of the House plan. It's definitely going to be part of the Senate plan.
Yeah, so our current income tax system is 7 brackets, which in case you don't know, whenever you reach a certain level of income, you reach a new bracket. So the one that we always hear about is the highest marginal tax bracket, which I believe is 39.6%, 38.6%. That actually, in the plans that have been put forth, is not changing. Mm-hmm. So that top bracket, we're not seeing an increased rate or a lowered rate. It's staying the same.
So for the wealthiest individuals paying individual income tax, there's no change being proposed.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also important, though, to take in mind that the top 1%, and this is, I think, 2013, 2014, the much beleaguered 1% in this country, they make about 19% of the income, and they pay about 38% of the income taxes. And so if you're designing an income tax reform, it's almost impossible mathematically to not disproportionately benefit those people that pay a disproportionate amount of the tax. Now, we could have a debate. Is that a good thing? Should we look at maybe cutting payroll taxes, which disproportionately benefit lower income people? I will absolutely get behind that, too. But I think it's important to have a sense of perspective when we're talking about income taxes.
So, I mean, one concern I have for this is probably what's going to be the crowding out effect. If they do enact major tax reforms that reduce revenue, then over time, this will crowd out things like Medicaid spending. Scott, your son is autistic, right? And probably a lot of people, a lot of elders, you know, when they who work their whole lives and then go through their assets for long-term care. Medicaid is a part of things like CHIP, things like Pell Grants, things like infrastructure. I mean, I think this whole thing, deficits don't matter, will pay for themselves. The real effect in the long run will be to crowd out those things that help ordinary working people get by.
I will say this. What you hear about Kansas, for example, is, yeah, Kansas didn't go so well. And why? And some people say it's because Kansas made all these huge changes in taxes, but didn't really control their spending.
Those damn public schools and universities, right?
Well, it's not like it's not like there's no fat to cut. But anyway, you can't, it doesn't go really well at the state level if you radically slash taxes, but don't slash spending. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising that bad things happen, especially when you have balanced budget amendments that you have to hit.
Exactly. And that's sort of where states get into trouble, because oftentimes whenever conservatives or libertarians or whomever on the quote right talk about this stuff, it's often in the medium to long term. Well, budgets are a short-term issue. And so sure, while your package that you implemented may benefit 5, 10, 20 years down the road, you have to meet your budget this year. And Kansas also did some really wacky stuff as far as what's called pass-through businesses, where they basically exempted a huge portion of the value-producing economy from having to pay taxes.
In other words, if I was an accountant, instead of being an employee and having to pay those wages, I instead became an independent contractor, a small business person, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, and then I got exemptions.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm unaware of any serious conservative economist or anything that would say, like, that's a really good idea. You should exempt. You should narrow the base in that type of way.
Did they just, I mean, you know, they had very intelligent people helping Kansas design this. Did they not see that unintended consequence?
Well, my guess is, I mean, with any time you're talking about public policy, different special interest groups involved, an army of lobbyists to send on there, and they can make just about anything sound like a really, really good idea.
Yeah, I don't think people who make these decisions are motivated by sheer rational discourse, Scott.
Yeah, maybe I'm
public
too
choice 101.
Well, that's true. So when you're making a change like this, it's an opportunity to get your special interest written into tax law, too. Part of the fight right now is, for example, should people be able to write off state income tax on their federal income tax, which they can do. And in West Virginia, not such a big deal. It's not very much. But if you live in New York, California.
Illinois, yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. Do you guys have a stance on that write off and whether that's a good or bad thing?
I think it's a good idea to eliminate that type of subsidy that goes from states like West Virginia to New Jersey or Connecticut. I understand, but I also think it should be done responsibly, and it shouldn't be done all in one fell swoop. I think a phase out makes sense.
Can you get behind that? Is there a kumbaya moment here? Sticking it to New York and California?
Well, I mean, there are probably a lot of people I'm okay with sticking it to, but I have like a different sort of take on that.
Okay, go ahead.
One, like in the big picture, we're living in a time of extreme inequality, which hasn't been this high since probably the 1920s. Brandeis said you can have either extreme inequality of wealth or democracy, but probably not both. Economic power leads to political power because you can lobby, you can pay for campaigns. So a massive transfer of wealth where it's already massively done. I mean, just look what's going to happen in the Senate race. It's all going to be about just floods of money. So do we just want to go for, like, you know, auctioning off public office and public policy?
You say that like it's a fact, but there's some counterfactuals. Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, they weren't the best funded campaigns. Even Donald Trump was outspent by Hillary Clinton. I'm not 1,000% convinced that we're an oligarchy and, you know, it's all hope is lost for democracy.
I think if you look at our Western neighbors, Kentucky, Matt Bevin was basically kind of an unknown, a not well-funded candidate at all, and kind of came out of nowhere to kind of win that gubernatorial race. So, yeah,
I mean, I'm not pretending that money has no impact.
Sure,
I mean, we have a billion. West Virginia has one billionaire. That billionaire is the governor. Those things are related.
And there's a lot of dark money that floods into these things. And also, you know, if people have extreme amounts of power, they don't need to like vulgarly display it. You know,
what do you mean by that?
If you have huge amounts of power and influence, you know, you have clout without even asking for it. That's what John Govinda in Power and Powerlessness in Appalachia talked about. You have the power to keep things from becoming an issue. You have this enormous hegemony or influence that you exert throughout the media, throughout civil society, throughout the political system. We can pretend that it's not I wish it wasn't. I wish I was right there with you, Scott.
I have a couple different thoughts on that. Where liberals and conservatives, libertarians sort of talk past each other, it's sort of this fixed pie fallacy that you know, you have the top 1% and the rest of us all fighting over the same 12-inch pie. I think through efforts like tax reform or deregulating or things like that, what you're actually trying to do is take that 12-inch pie and make it into a 15-inch pie. The standard of living in this country has continued to increase through recessions, through depressions, through whatever. The fact of the matter is we all live better now than what we did in the past.
Well, I'll take you to task on that. I think many of us live better, but I think where that's starting to break down is there are percentiles in America, maybe, I don't know if it's the bottom half or the bottom 40%, where they've seen just kind of more of a stagnation.
I guess what I mean by that is a more sort of holistic quality of life that your average poor family has access to entertainment, has access to high quality things, has access to air conditioning. Whereas in 50, 60 years ago, the people in those same percentiles would not have had access to that type of thing.
Better health care, for example.
Better everything. Really. Better cars, better cell phones, better computers. All of our lives have been improved.
Mm-hmm. So even if we're not, even if you look at those charts that show that for certain parts of America or Americans, their income as in relation to inflation and other things has been relatively stagnant for a couple of decades. But what you're saying is, yeah, but we have iPhones.
So here's my but.
Or refrigerators or our medical care. Everything's
cheaper.
Better.
Except for medical care.
Phones and toys and stuff like that are cheaper, but healthcare probably.
Toys?
Like
my
that.
Phone is not a toy. My phone is an important part of my life.
Some of the big ticket items have gotten more and more expensive. And the thing that really affects people, even in terms of public health, is your relative position within a society, so relative poverty. So if you have extreme inequality within a society, there's a lot of evidence that it affects how
cohesive
a society is.
Was that an attitude issue? I mean, if I'm better off than I was, I know you're right, by the way. I mean, if we give...
Are you going to edit that?
No, I won't. I won't. If you look, I've ran organizations, this one and others before, and if you give someone a raise, or let's say you give everybody a raise in the organization, but you give some people more of a raise than others and then they find it out, it's almost better that you didn't give them a raise because it's that feeling of like, it's not just am I doing better, but am I doing better in relation to that guy? Which I find kind of depressing, actually.
Even public health info research on that. It's kind of interesting.
That's also sort of a very primal instinct that I think that can be very dangerous in a democracy. This country, by and large, has not begrudged successful people. We've not wanted to kind of soak the rich or anything like that. And I think in our current just sort of environment of polarization, the sort of idea that the rich people are out to get us or that whatever the opposite side of that is, or the Democrats are party of the poor, Republicans hate poor people, or whatever it may be, I think from just a civic perspective, that's a very dangerous thing to go down that road. But also, I think it's also not – inequality is not – I'll probably stumble around this, but it's unclear to me that it's prima facie a bad thing. I think it's important to see how did people become unequal. Did that top percentage or 10% or 20%, did they get wealthy by expanding the pie? Did they get wealthy by inventing Apple? Did they get wealthy by screwing other people over?
Or by inheriting money when there's no estate tax?
I think
or by gaming the system.
That's a very important question.
Well, and the estate tax is a great question about this, because on one hand, you might look at it in terms of do the children of the wealthy deserve to get this benefit that they didn't earn?
You're going to tax the labor of the poor and their payroll, but this
yeah,
is
but,
a
but you're going to pass on your farm to your kids, aren't you?
My farm is not worth
your multi-million dollar agricultural operation. Yeah. But you say that with like you're laughing, but to some guy in Nicaragua, you're rich. And you're passing your wealth on to your kids. I want to do that the same way. And so.
Yeah, and you can do that. And like the estate tax only kicks in at a very high level.
So,
and it's only a proportion.
But you're rich. You're
rich in part because you live in a democracy where there are things like police and there's army and there's roads and there's a post office and there's public investments that make science and the internet possible.
I just think at some point the danger here, though, is that, well, as long as it doesn't affect me, someone else can pay that tax. When you start having taxes that they're like, well, we'll have this really onerous tax, but it only affects that little tiny portion of society and not me, and I'm okay with that. I think it's useful to remember that to everyone in Nicaragua, every single one of us is a rich person. I mean, compared to the way they live, and yet we don't want to have an estate tax that transfers all our wealth to Nicaragua. I mean, there's some hypocrisy there too.
Is that on the table right now? Because I missed that somewhere.
I'm just saying,
but it's an interesting philosophical question, though, right? Like, should our moral compass to some extent be dictated by, does this person have more money than me? And again, I think this country was built on the concept of individual liberty, the fact that the individual is sort of prime. And so we had certain protections put in place by the founding fathers that said, we're not going to let a tyranny of the majority take over, and we're also not going to let a tyranny of the minority take over.
Speaking of onerous taxes, there to go to your thing, Scott, like the way it's now, you know, low-income people pay a much higher share of their income in taxes like that are like consumption and other taxes, which some people even wanted to make worse. So whose onerous taxes do you care about?
I think those are people
who work.
Exactly. And that's where resentment comes from, because I think there is a class of people that look above them and see extremely wealthy people getting away with not paying, or they think they're not paying as much as they should. I mean, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but there's a perception. And then they see people that aren't paying anything into the system and they resent them too. And that leads to a lot of anger, and that anger is not a healthy thing for democracy, I don't think.
I think what we're seeing now is a lot of people focus their resentment on people who are actually doing worse, people who are marginal. I think racism has been a big part of how people look at things like public policy and spending, and blaming immigrants or blaming poor people for their personal faults. And I think most people, it takes a certain amount of courage to take on the more powerful, but it doesn't take a lot to beat up on people who can't fight back or who aren't quite prepared to fight back as well as I'd like to see them.
We were talking about some guiding principles. And I'm trying to see, are there guiding principles that you both agree on in terms of taxation?
We like the song.
What about everybody contributes and everybody benefits? I mean, wouldn't that be a
basic thing?
Now
you're talking my language now. I'm very much a... either a flat tax or pure, just everybody pay 10%. If you make $1,000 a year, you pay 10%. If you make $1 billion a year, you pay 10%. Again, it gets to your point as far as disproportionality, and that's a discussion that we can have. But I think really that's the most kind of equality under the law type of thing. Now, if you want to introduce, I understand there are caveats to that. But whenever you deviate from that, then you begin to enter into these questions about who are we soaking, who has the most political power.
Okay, I'm going to be the conservative here, the Edmund Burke conservative. If you take a really complex system and then wipe it all out overnight, then you're going to be in for a goat rope, you know.
So, and what's a goat rope for those who are
a real mess, you know, that, you know, life is complicated. Things evolve over time. And, you know, just like the French Revolution, where you're going to change the calendar and rename the months and everything else overnight.
And I think actually it's a good point. And it's about West Virginia too, by the way. Do we need radical change? I mean, we know things are really wrong. Which direction they're wrong in, I think you two would debate about forever. But you agree some things are radically not right here. Is the better way to go small incremental changes over time, or, you know, rip off the Band-Aid sort of thing?
I'll sort of give a classically disappointing answer. I think it depends on what you're talking about.
Yeah, we have unity there.
I think certain things, sort of an incremental approach, that makes sense. Like we're talking about the phase out of the state and local income tax deduction. I think that kind of incremental approach makes sense. Some things, and I know we'll probably disagree with this, on like education policy, for example, I think we need a radical change in this state, and I'd like to see some sort of school choice or something like that. So I think it depends. And I really like the Edmund Burke thing. I don't remember if it was him, but it said traditions are often answers to forgotten questions. And I think that's important to keep in mind here as well. But Scott, I tell you what, on your flat income tax thing, you almost sound like a conservative libertarian guy over there.
Shocking on NPR. All right. Hey, and we'll have to have like a quote off between you two someday, because okay, I think you two both got the goods and I don't. But.
I've got Lao Tzu, chapter 77, Tao Te Ching, that the way of heaven is like the bending of a bow. What is high is brought down. What is low is brought up. The way of people is different, is to take from those who have too little and give to those who have too much.
Isn't he a communist?
pre-industrial, so you didn't really have that whole thing going on.
I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Special thanks to Garrett Ballingy from the Cardinal Institute. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Always enjoy it.
And Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee.
Thanks, Scott. Party on, Garrett.
Party on, Rick.
All right.
Take care. No.
world that's gonna be.